It's good to have Brother Andy and Sister Angie with us again at Shirley. And I'll call upon Brother Andy to give us words of exhortation.
Thank you, Rick. It's lovely to be with you all this morning. It's always a bit like coming home, coming back to Shirley. It's spent so long here. The faces change. Amazingly, you don't look like you're aging too much. A lot of you are hanging on in really well there, so that's good. As you might know, I was pretty poorly a bit earlier on in the year, and I'm firing on most cylinders now, I think. So just wanted to say thank you for all the thoughts and prayers and cards. It really does help when you're in, when you're feeling and are poorly, knowing that we've got so many brothers and sisters that are praying and thinking about you makes a whole heap of difference, I've got to say. So that was much appreciated. I bring with me the love of the brothers and sisters at Tewkesbury. We've been operating as an ecclesia now for about 9 years, it is 9 years next week, and we start off with 15 brothers and sisters, and we're now 25 brothers and sisters, so we're a fraction of the size of Shirley. Our announcements are much quicker, which is great. No, it isn't. It's lovely to hear in a big meeting just how much is going on. Our announcements take much shorter. But we've had 10 baptisms in those 9 years, five of our own young people, five as a direct result of the seminars. We brought two people back into fellowship. A brother who was out of fellowship is now back in fellowship. A sister that was out of fellowship is now back in fellowship. We've had three weddings. We've had two funerals. Not four. And it's amazing, really, even in a small little ecclesia like Tewkesbury, all elements of life are coming at it thick and fast. And there's, you know, times of joy in the ecclesia, there's times of difficulty in the ecclesia, there's times of sadness in the ecclesia, there's all those things. And I suppose it's just the same as a family, isn't it? Because in every family, all of those things somehow, you know, life isn't smooth. There's always something, either joy or sadness or difficulties, they all come at you. And we have to cope with them, and we have to get through them. And we were talking, this was going back about 2 months ago, we were wondering about doing a special effort in Tewkesbury, and we decided to do, why we picked this number, I don't really know, but we thought we'd do, well I do know, because it was Angie that came up with the idea, I shouldn't really take it away from her. She said, why don't we do like three special talks and advertise, you know, a sort of a little mini series. And so that's what we decided to do. And it was basically under the overall theme of, is the Bible relevant for today? And anyway, we put out some adverts and we did some billing, and we had a couple of people come along. But just before we did this, we've only done the one actually, we've still got the other two coming up. Just before we did the very first one, I actually found, I was just hunting in some ancient history of Tewkesbury, and found that Christadelphians had been preaching in Tewkesbury a long, long, long time ago. And I found this advert that had been put out. I'm going to tell you what it said on the advert. At the top of the advert, it said, "The coming of the Lord draweth nigh," James 5, verse 8. Three lectures. I thought, well, that's interesting, three lectures. "Will be delivered by Robert Roberts of Birmingham at the Music Hall in Tewkesbury on Monday the 23rd, Tuesday the 24th, Wednesday the 25th of September, 1867, at 8 o'clock in the evening." And that hall that Robert Roberts spoke in is still there. It's changed its name. It's now the James Watson Hall. And so 152 years ago, there's Robert Roberts turning up at Tewkesbury doing three lectures. But what absolutely astounded me was this. There was the commentary on his series of three lectures said that 300 of the respectability of Tewkesbury turned up. 300. We got two. Now, maybe Robert Roberts was somebody that was, you know, he was clearly a crowd pleaser. I mean, he was pulling in the people. I mean, 152 years ago, how many people were living in Tewkesbury? It's not that big now. It would have been a fraction of the number. There's probably a few thousand people. And we were sat there thinking, how did Robert Roberts, with a tiny advert, get 300 people to come to that? And maybe there's two reasons for that. One of them possibly is that back then there wasn't much entertainment, I sort of think. You've probably got a candle and a pack of cards. I mean, I don't know what else they did back then. There wasn't much going on. They certainly weren't pressing a button and glued to something on the TV, were they, in 1867? There might have been a few inns open. It was probably a good night out. But also, I'm pretty certain that 150 years ago, most people were religious. And back in that time period, people were interested. You know, the dark ages of Catholicism had gone, I know, long, you know, before then. But the 1800s was a time when people were seriously looking at the Bible and trying to work out what it said. And what a difference 150 years makes. Because now, do people, are they still interested in this? Well, clearly not. We've seen every single year, and we've done the seminars every single year since 1998, and every single year the numbers come down. Every year. It's really, really difficult to, because now, as Christians, you know, we're seen as super fringe, strange people, I think. That's what, you know, people look at you as if you're some crazy person. 150 years ago, most people believed in God. Now, most people definitely do not. We actually did a Bible Learning Centre in Tewkesbury a few years ago, and we had a creation exhibition as you came in, and in fact we had got the TV screen at the front playing a creation exhibition, creation story. What, my goodness me, the noise that we got on the back of that was unbelievable. There was a Facebook page set up to vilify what we were doing. There were people that would come in the shop and shout at us. It was the creation bit that wound them up. And for the first time, I realised just how much sort of, you know, feeling there is in almost like a hatred about what we were trying to do. I mean, somebody on Facebook said, we're going to set up a Satanist shop next door to you. You know, why should you have a shop about God? And that's the world in which we lived. It wasn't like that 150 years ago. I think at best now, people see Christians, like this is just my experience, maybe yours is different, but, you know, if we put ourselves in this whole category of Christians, I think most people would say that at best we are foolish and just a little bit childish, a little bit simple. You believe in God? Well, you certainly haven't caught up with the times then, have you? You know, I get that sort of reaction at work and with people that I talk to. They sort of just feel a little bit sorry for me. You're a little bit simple, aren't you? You know. Surely you understand that we've evolved from monkeys. You must understand that there isn't a God. Haven't you watched the latest thing on by Attenborough who tells us these things, you know, or whatever it is? But at worst, we're seen as child abusers. You know, if you read Dawkins' book, then he says that if you teach your children about Christianity, if you teach them from the Bible, you're the equivalent of a child abuser. That's exactly what he says in his book. And that's what we are up against. And anything we watch on the TV to do with nature, for one, everything is coming at it from the point of view that God does not exist. And we're getting this pummeled at us all the time. And I think, when we've got all of this, sometimes we can sit there perhaps and think, we are in a serious minority. And maybe we stop and think, have I lost my marbles? Am I crazy to believe in God? Am I crazy to believe in this ancient book? And sometimes when it's bombarded at us all the time, these things can happen in our minds. And we've got to be careful, because the world is trying to tell us we are stupid, basically. And really, of course, as Christadelphians, we are a minority of a minority. So when we opened the Bible Learning Centre, we had people coming in who were Christians, who as soon as found out that we were Christadelphians, walked straight out, because we don't believe in the Trinity and we don't believe in the devil and blah, blah, blah. And so therefore, we're even more as a tiny fraction of a minority. The number of Christadelphians in this world is a 0.0001% of the population. We're minuscule. And all of that can make us feel quite isolated. And you might say, why am I going on about all of this stuff? Get on with an exhortation. But here's the thing. You see, in 2 Chronicles 32, which we didn't read this morning, but it's our reading for this morning. You don't have to look it up, because I'm going to read a bit to you from a modern version. But in that chapter, there is Hezekiah in Jerusalem, and he is in a bit of a mess, because surrounding him is this pretty awful Assyrian army that's been ransacking and defeating nation after nation, and now they've rocked up at his front door, basically. And Sennacherib, I'm going to read to you what Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, who's steamrolled through the Middle East, I'm going to read to you what Sennacherib said to Hezekiah. I'm going to read it from a modern version. This is the New Living Translation, but it sort of just says it as it is. Have a listen to this. So this is Sennacherib talking. And here's what he says. Surely you must realize what I and the other kings of Assyria before me have done to all the people of the earth. Were any of the gods of those nations able to rescue their people from my power? Which of their gods was able to rescue its people from the destructive power of my predecessors? What makes you think your God can rescue you from me? Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. Don't let him fool you like this. I say it again, no god of any nation or kingdom has ever yet been able to rescue his people from me or my ancestors. How much less will your God rescue you from my power? I mean, if this chap was going to get, some sort of score on mocking God, he's got a distinction. He's doing really well. He's absolutely slaying down to the people and saying, don't listen to Hezekiah. You're trusting in God? What planet are you on? Look at me. And this is exactly the sort of thing that we're up against, that people say to us, you believe in God? You do what? What sort of crazy world are you living in, for goodness sake? Look at the science. And what Sennacherib is saying is, look at the evidence that I am actually all-powerful, almighty, even my predecessors. Stop trusting in God. It's totally the same mocking derision that we also can experience. But how does Hezekiah respond? And this is the key, okay? Because Hezekiah could have been thinking, oh my word, he's absolutely right. You know, he has done all of that. And here we are, holed up with thousands, hundreds of thousands of severely nasty-looking people surrounding us. Perhaps we should compromise. I mean, this is a great danger in our community at the minute, that we start thinking perhaps we shouldn't talk about creation, because that's causing a real rumpus. Right, let's get rid of that. Perhaps we should change the way we operate, because it upsets some other Christian religion. Right, yeah, let's sort that. That's an idea. Let's compromise on that. And suddenly we water everything down. Did Hezekiah do that? Did he get all of his officials together and say, right, we are in some serious trouble here. Perhaps we should make a deal with this guy. Maybe we should accept that he is who he is. And maybe we can do some sort of arrangement with him that sort of gives us peace. We just want peace. We don't want to be destroyed. Here's what Hezekiah said. Same chapter, same version. Hezekiah got all the people together. Hezekiah encouraged the people by saying, "Be strong and courageous. Don't be afraid or discouraged because of the king of Assyria or his mighty army, for there is a power far greater on our side. He may have a great army, but they are merely men. We have the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles for us." And Hezekiah's words greatly encouraged the people. Well, well, well. Now that's a heck of a statement, isn't it, from Hezekiah? Be strong. Be courageous. Don't be afraid. Don't be discouraged. And you imagine if right now, surrounding this very building, were hundreds of people threatening our lives. Right this minute. They're all outside. They're clamouring to get in. They want to destroy us. And somebody at the front said, "Don't worry, be strong and courageous. God's on our side." You'd still be worrying, wouldn't you? But people listened to Hezekiah. And they took great courage in what he said to them. And I think when we feel that we are seriously in the minority and seriously on our own, which we can do because, as we said, we're a minority of a minority, we have to think of these words of Hezekiah. There are more on, well, in the AV, this is how it puts it. It says, this is what Hezekiah says. He says, "There are more who are with us than with him." You see, after all, brothers and sisters, we are not in the minority. It looks and feels like we're in the minority because there's 60,000 or so Christadelphians versus 7 billion. And yet, we're not in the minority. To start with, we've got the most all-powerful, awesome creator of everything that's put the whole world together totally on our side, for one. On top of that, we've also got the Lord Jesus Christ, who is currently and will be physically soon the king of this entire world. He is in control of who is in government at the minute, but when he comes back, he'll take over. And he knows exactly what we've gone through. So we've got somebody with 100% empathy of what we also suffer. And if that wasn't enough, we've got countless legions of angels, supernatural, perfect, immortal beings whose sole role, as far as we know, is only this. And that is to get us, mortal human beings, into the glorious kingdom that's coming. As far as we know, there is no other work that angels do apart from to help minister to those who are heirs of salvation. That's it. There might be, you know, other job parts of their job description, but as far as we know, that's it. So God has given us immortal angels to help us get into the kingdom. You know, when it said about there are more who were with us than with him, wouldn't it be nice to flick a switch occasionally when our faith wavers a bit? Wouldn't it be nice to flick a switch and see the angels working? Wouldn't it be? I mean, they're in this room right now. We can't see it. Oh, if only we could see. My faith would go up a lot. Flick the switch. There are the angels in this room. I don't know how many are in this room right now, but where two or three are gathered together, they're there. There's probably quite a few interested in what we're doing right now. And as we leave this place and wander off to go to work or wander off to do whatever we're doing with our families or whatever, the angels are there. And by the way, they're not just like clearing away the rubble in front of us so our path is beautifully smooth. Oh, I know an angel's with me because look how wonderful my life is. It doesn't work like that. In fact, quite often they might put something in our way to see how we react. You know those Assyrians who were surrounding Jerusalem? God manufactured it so that they would, to see how Hezekiah was going to react. So angels aren't making our path smooth, but they are helping us to get to the kingdom. That is absolutely the case. It reminds me a little bit, do you remember Elisha? And there's this great big army, and his servant is dithering, and oh my goodness, look at this army, Elisha. What on earth are we going to do? And in 2 Kings 6, it says, when the servants of the man of God got up early the next morning and went outside, there were troops and horses and chariots everywhere. Oh, sir, what are we going to do now? The young man cried to Elisha. I've got to turn the page to find out. Right, here we are. Don't be afraid, Elisha told him, for there are more on our side than on theirs. Similar words, aren't they, that Hezekiah said. Then Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes and let him see. And the Lord opened the young man's eyes. And when he looked up, he saw the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. There aren't many times in the Bible where the switch was flicked and suddenly we saw what was really going on. But we've got to believe that if we flicked that switch this second, we would see a similar scene to what Elisha and that young servant actually saw. And do you know something? I think when we get to the kingdom shortly, when we get there, we're probably going to be shown just how much effort was put into our lives by God, by Christ, and by countless angels to get us there. And we'll look and say, well, I had no idea that that happened in my life, that meant that that was going to happen, that that was going to happen, that was going to bring me to here. No, do you know what? I thought I did it of my own strength. I thought I got that job because I was clever. I thought I ended up in that ecclesia because of, you know, a particular random event. I thought I ended up with that partner because I just happened to meet that lady or girl, whoever it was. I had no idea that the angels were there making these. I had no idea. And that is the amazing thing that we will find out. These angels aren't sat around doing nothing. They're working full time for us. And here we are, as we've just read in Daniel chapter 12, at the very, very time of the end. And now is not the time to give up, is it? I know there are definitely some leaving the truth right now. It's like running an enormous long race and the finishing line is just about where that organ is and thinking, well, I've run probably 26 miles, but it's a long way to go, that last little bit. You know what? I'm just going to stop. I'm just going to stop now. What's the point of stopping when it's so close? It's absolute craziness to stop now. What did we read in Daniel chapter 12? That at the time of the end, men will rush to and fro and knowledge will increase. If you want to give me a better description in 8 words of the time of the end, then go ahead and be my guest, because I don't think you'll do it. I actually think Daniel was taken mentally and shown a picture of the world right now. He was probably somewhere near junction 5 of the M42, right? This is what I imagine, that God gives him a vision of junction 5 of the M42. And says, this is the world, this is the future time of the end. And Daniel's given this vision in his mind of the future. And he sees these things, he doesn't know what they are, they're racing along. That was me going by, straight down the motorway at 70 miles an hour exactly. And he sees these things hurtling around. And then he sees this thing flying over him, it's landing at the NEC there, and it's coming in at Birmingham Airport. This thing's flying in the sky, hundreds of miles an hour, he can't believe what he sees. God says, write down what you saw at the time of the end. He says, well, I see men rushing to and fro, and knowledge has increased. I can't even describe what I see. For 6,000 years, we went at 1 horsepower. That's what we went at. Maybe 2 if you had a carriage or something, but that was it. Now I can redo my car and get it doing 300 horsepower. I can fly in the air. I can talk to somebody in Australia right now at the other end of the world. I can FaceTime Keith Shirley and see his face on my phone and press another button and it goes. No, I wouldn't do that to Keith. But do you see what I mean? This is where we are at the very, very time of the end. And we're surrounded right now, even though we feel like we're in the minority, we're not. And we come now to remember Jesus. Now you tell me of anybody else that was in a minority like this man. Who else was on? Who had his back? A few disciples. But when the crunch came, they all forsook him and fled. He was utterly... He could have thought, oh, I better compromise because I'm really struggling here. Nobody's listening to me. I'm doing all this preaching. I'm getting nowhere. I'm going to change the message. It will just be a lot easier. In fact, what I might do is just speed the whole thing up and become king now. Do you know something? He thought that. The Gospels tell us he thought exactly that to start with. He thought, I could actually take over the world right now. And he thought, no, I'm not going to. I'm going to follow the Lord God. I'm going to trust in him. Jesus was utterly isolated, utterly on his own. And he decided in that Garden of Gethsemane to utterly and completely trust in God, despite being a minority of one. But do you know something? He knew he had got angels and God at his side, backing him and with him. It didn't take the pain away, didn't make that crucifixion any easier, really, because he had to get through horrific, horrific time. And yet he decided, you want me to do this? I will trust in you. I don't think anybody was scoffed or mocked or as alone or without friends as much as the Lord Jesus Christ. But through his amazing confidence in what he could not see, the faith he had and the hope for the future, we, thousands of years later, can sit here with utter and complete confidence that just like Hezekiah, we can be strong, we can be courageous. We're not in the minority. Brothers and sisters, we've got the backing of the whole universe, the creator of the universe behind us. And therefore, when Christ comes very, very soon, we will see all this horror and mess disappear and be granted, God willing, a place to live in that kingdom with him forever.